The following episode of the Smashing Punkcast was recorded before the allegations against Brian Warner, aka Marilyn Manson, came to light. Any commentary on Marilyn Manson tracks in this episode in no way reflects support for Marilyn Manson.
Yeah, we just wanted to let you guys know that we just didn't want you guys to think that after all this big news, all we could do is sit and say like, hey, this track is pretty chill. So anyway, just wanted to clarify that we recorded this a while ago. And yeah, we don't support any of the we don't apologize or support for any of the stuff that he is accused of doing. So with that, on with the show.
Turn to the gates of heaven. It's the Smashing Pumpcast. I'm Frank Garcia Hale.
I'm Pat O'Brien. And whoo boy, I'm excited about this one. Today we're talking about a great, great Pumpkin song from one of the great soundtracks, I'm going to say, of all time. I can't speak for the future. I don't have any abilities to see into it, but...
You're not a precog?
I'm not a total precog. I am working on... I think they have a master class on how to be one now.
Right. You're a quarter precog.
Yeah, quarter cog. post-cog. Yeah, I'm doing some post-grad work. Anyway, folks, we are talking about the Lost Highway soundtrack.
That's right. It's another edition of the Pumpcast Goes to the Movies.
Oh, boy. Well, this is fun because obviously we can't go to the movies. I've been, no. I don't know about you. I think maybe we talked about this last time. The pressure's been, you know, we have children, we have other things to do anyway, but it's starting to like the inability to just do a simple thing like go to the movies or obviously a concert. It's starting to take its toll. It's starting to really suck. I think I could suspend it for a while, but it's like I've been like more sad about it lately, or kind of mourning it more.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think part of that, I think too, is that we're coming up on a year.
Right.
So I think that has a lot to do with it. And also the fact that, like, hey, I mean, we're on the right track as far as, like, we got, you know, a vaccination and stuff. We won't get too political here, but just, like, we are starting to make certain strides to try to get back to a place where we can get somewhat stable, especially with the vaccine. But, you know, there's a lot that still needs to be done, and I honestly don't see this shaking out anytime soon to where we can return back. I don't know if we'll ever return back to the way it was, to be honest with you, fully.
Not for
another few years, but I think that, like, hopefully, my hope is by fall or winter, we can kind of have some kind of semblance of a concert or movie going experience. But I have a feeling it's going to change a lot. We're going to have to make some, you know, changes to how we used to do things. So who knows?
Yeah, that's for sure.
I am not a clairvoyant or, you know, I don't have access to the, was it Akashic calendar? What is it called? Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like the stream of the stream of time where you can see the past and the present and possible futures.
It's just a stitch in time.
No, but I'm glad I'm taking this this master class on how to be a precog, because I'm assuming they'll get to that in like lesson 8 or something.
The Akashic Records, I believe that's what it's called. I can't remember. I'm probably saying it wrong. And those of you who are in the spiritual world, I apologize for butchering it.
Not to be confused with the Akashic Records, those great albums by The Cars.
That's right.
Oh, boy. Well, speaking of cars, speaking of driving, we got a lot to talk about today. We're talking about the soundtrack and the movie Lost Highway. I was just telling Frank, I actually did watch the movie last night. It's fresh in my mind. I hadn't seen it since probably 1997 when it came out at my friend Tyler's house. I was in middle school. And I think I was far too young, too freaked out, and maybe I fell asleep. I didn't retain much of it, but the soundtrack has been with me. Like, it's never left my life. Frank? What's your relationship to this soundtrack, to the movie, to the song?
I mean, I was already a Lynch fan from Twin Peaks. And I remember reading somewhere like in Film Threat or whatever, one of those types of magazines, that he was making a new one and that Trent Reznor was going to be helping out. And of course, I've talked about this. We've talked about this many times on the show about my love for Nine Inch Nails and Trent Reznor and the parallels between them and the Pumpkins. And I read that he was involved with the soundtrack, but it wasn't until later that I found out that, I think it was MTV News again, that the Pumpkins would be part of it. And I was stoked. I was like, you got David Lynch, you got Trent Reznor, and then I think at that time they had announced David Bowie too.
Right.
And, you know, and you got the Pumpkins. I was like, that's it. You know, this soundtrack's going to be fucking awesome. And I saw the movie. I didn't see it when it came out in theaters, but I saw it on VHS. I rented it from Blockbuster Video, and that's actually where I bought the soundtrack from too.
Oh, nice!
Because that was the closest I had access to it at that time. But being a Nine Inch Nails fan and being a Bowie fan, this soundtrack had quite a bit to offer that I was really psyched on. And I think at the time I couldn't really appreciate. We'll get into this later, but like I think it had enough for me to appreciate, but then also stuff that I skipped. Of course. But I remember being a little baffled by the movie. It wasn't my favorite Lynch movie at that time. I was just getting into him, and I was still kind of like, I think I'm sticking to Twin Peaks for the most part.
How old were you when you watched Twin Peaks? I'm just curious.
I was young.
Did you watch
it
like when it was on TV?
I watched it on TV with my grandma, because my grandma was she is a huge like horror fan. And we would watch like Elvira together. We'd watch, she had all this original Stephen King books, and I would like read those, and I would get scared out of my mind, you know, just being like, just have nightmares all the time. But like, my family watched horror films. I've seen so many of those horror films like way too early. And so my grandma was really intrigued by the look and feel of Twin Peaks. So we would watch that together.
Your grandma sounds awesome, first of all.
She is.
I mean, yeah.
But she also, she's very a very stern, very a stern Latina woman who slept with a gun under her pillow. So
very Lynchian.
Yeah, exactly. There are elements of my grandmother's life that probably could be seen as Lynchian. Yeah.
Oh man. Well, I am David Lynch. Now and for many years now is just like many people. I'm not unique in this, and you're a big fan too. Like he is like just the top of the heap for me. I love Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks is one of my favorite just things. Not even TV shows, just like creative. I mean, it's such a massive, it's like a creative universe of an art project that just kind of like there's so much to it. I love it. I love the, you know, I love the weirdness of it. I think I was just too young. I was aware of Twin Peaks as like a big cultural thing, but to be totally honest, and I was young when it came out. It came out, what, 1990? Is that when
it's like 90, 91, I believe.
It was on for like 90, 91. Yeah. So at that point, I didn't watch either show, but like the name, I was aware of like Twin Peaks and Northern Exposure, which are very different shows. They were like interchangeable in my mind.
Oh, but, okay.
So this was like, this was probably, so before this, I didn't really know much about David Lynch. This was probably the first movie of his that I saw. Then I think I saw The Elephant Man. Then I saw Blue Velvet. But anyway, I've since, you know, read his books. I've seen him speak live. I'm a major devotee of his. I love, you know, the fact that he's like a visual artist. I love his love of music. I love the way he talks about art. I love how weird his shit is, but how unpretentious he is. You know, he's like so plain spoken about like ideas and creativity. And he's just this kind of straight shooting, like Midwestern guy. So anyway, this convergence of like, you know, the Pumpkin, all the, like, I just get so psyched when things that I love intersect. And the, even before liking Lynch, there were, you know, just the musicians on this soundtrack. There was, the like you said, the Nine Inch Nails and Pumpkins Convergence and Bowie. And it just felt like such an event, such a musical event. And I was talking about in our Batman and Robin episode, the feeling of kind of like, and we both were, of sort of like looking around and being like, guys, are you as into this as I am?
Right.
Your friends aren't like as on board anymore. This was actually the moment when I brought like this CD to school and was listening to it on my like Radio Shack Discman, knockoff Discman. Like, I remember, you know, being in my seventh grade classroom and truly like so stoked, like brimming with excitement about this soundtrack, about just like the in particular the song I. And what it represented for the Pumpkins, this like this band I loved, doing what was a pretty, to my ear, drastically different and awesome new sound. So this was ground zero of that moment of like, guys, are you fucking as psyched about this as I am? And kind of like, my friend Tyler, whose house I watched this movie at, was the biggest Nine Inch Nails head in the world from like a very young age, so it was sort of like my Pumpkins love like worked alongside, and I was also a big Nin head, but like it worked nicely alongside, you know, a couple of my other friends' Nine Inch Nails fandom.
Yeah, I think again, kind of the weird parallels that happened between the Pumpkins and Nine Inch Nails and Billy and Trent, because both of them were in a transition period. Because you have Trent in between the downward spiral and the Fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of anticipation there. And this is the one song that came out in between that people were like, oh, this is what new Nine Inch Nails is. This is what it's going to sound like. And then you have Billy on the other hand with I and The End is the Beginning is the End. And people looking to that being like, oh, this is going to be the new sound. So then also, Pumpkins release Adore. We'll get into this when we cover Adore, but like some people being like, what is this? I'm not into this. This isn't the Pumpkins. And then Nine Inch Nails releasing The Fragile and people kind of scratching their head being like, huh? Because it was one of the albums that like debuted high on the charts and then immediately fell quickly, right? Because they're like, this is a downward spiral part two.
Mm-hmm. So it's where, yeah, and it's like The Fragile, which, man, I've been meaning to dig back into that, but you're getting into like more atmospheric, like almost more ambient elements of Trent Reznor, which we've all come to know.
Yeah.
Also, by the way, is this the first soundtrack he worked on, Trent Reznor?
No, he did Natural Born Killers.
Oh, that's right. Another classic soundtrack of the 90s. Holy shit. I forgot about that one.
Might have done something else before that, but before this, he had done work for Natural Born Killers.
Okay, so that was a couple years prior, but but it's still the same, like, you know, I just watched the Pixar movie Soul a couple of weeks ago. So, like, looking at this journey of, like, Natural Born Killers, Lost Highway, to a children's... Granted, it is about death. It is about death, you know?
Yeah.
Very much about death.
There's a lot of heavy themes in there that are handled very well.
Mm-hmm. And visually, it was, like, really... I thought there was some really, really cool visual stuff in that movie, too. But Trent Reznor has now emerged... Obviously, people still know and love Nine Inch Nails, but he is like now known in a very... Has he won Oscars yet? He probably has. Yeah, he's like
for the Social Network. That was their first Oscar. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So mainstream, you know, film composer Trent Reznor. The seeds of that were definitely growing. This was the first couple of years of those seeds sprouting. But yeah, I did really enjoy watching this movie last night, and it was very interesting to see because, you know, we've lived with the soundtrack for years. Probably a lot of people listening have listened to these songs. I've known it as a soundtrack first, and I've read David Lynch's writings about just how he uses music in film, and he's like very much like, it's gotta work. Even if you love a song, like if it doesn't work, you just kind of can't, you gotta let it go, you can't put it in a scene. And I always thought this album is so stacked with like not pop artists, but like popular musicians do it like with songs, not just like score, not just the, you know, like I always thought like, could all of these work as well as he says they need to, you know, like, or is there a little bit of like, this is the music David Lynch and Trent Reznor were like really into at the time. But watching it, all the songs are in the movie and then some, which I do want to talk about the song that isn't on the soundtrack. They all work in the movie, and watching it, they're surprisingly thematically and even lyrically like very relevant to the story, including I, which I never even, I've enjoyed all these songs as like part of a mood, part of a, you know, burned together in my brain, but it was surprising to see how, I guess just coming off of Batman, the From and Inspired By sort of type of soundtrack is what we talked about last. Yeah. All of these are woven into the movie really well. Perfect Drug is the one that you only get a little taste of, the sort of the breakdown, you know, the kind of the crazy beat breakdown. But everything is not only works, but like the songs are kind of about the movie more than I remembered or more than I thought they would be.
Yeah, and I think just to kind of clarify here, we're going backwards a little bit because we had covered The End is the Beginning is the End first, when technically this one came out before that track. And we were going to wait to do this track, but we honestly thought like, well, in order to cover Adore, I think we do need to cover this.
Yes.
There's just that period between Melancholy and Adore that we find that's very important. So we wanted to make sure that, as with the last episode with James's Let It Come Down, it's a part of it. It's a part of that that gap and that growing period that we felt like, well, maybe we should visit I after all. Mm-hmm. And so just some facts. This came out on February 18th, 1997. That's when the soundtrack came out. And correct me if I'm wrong here, Pat. It was Lynch himself who requested that Billy submit a track, correct?
Yeah, yes. And initially, the track that he submitted was Tear. I saw you there. He submitted that to Lynch because Lynch said, you know, I think you're great. You know, I want a song from you.
Yep. He said, send it back. It's not good enough, Billy.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't have the crackle of it. Yeah. So this is where it gets kind of interesting. Billy had been approached about working with Shaquille O'Neal. Do you know that many details about this? And he had been sort of playing around with sounds and producing kind of beats,
right,
in anticipation of perhaps collaborating with Shaquille O'Neal, the musician.
Oh, Shaquille O'Neal.
Yeah, the Irish musician.
Shaquille O'Neal.
Shaquille O'Neal. That's so funny to think of, like, for Shaquille O'Neal, like, to go down in history as primarily a musician.
Shaq Fu. But this was for his album, You Can't Stop the Rain. That's what it was being considered for. From what I understand, from what I've kind of cobbled together from various interviews, and especially the way that Billy, because somebody recently asked him on a Q&A, I say recently, but it was within the past year, if like, hey, is it true that you wrote that song for Shaq? And he's like, well, it's not entirely true. And I think, yeah, he just kind of was messing around with some like bare beats and stuff, and I think just kind of entertaining the idea, and I'm sure that he probably sent it along to his people, and his people were like, eh, that's fine, no thanks, and he just had, you know, I don't think it got anywhere past like that, just the kind of, you know, as we do in the industry, being like, hey, we should collaborate sometime, and then stuff just doesn't work out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, we know that Billy was hanging out, like, with basketball superstars in the 90s. You go to parties, everybody's...
Maybe that's what happened.
Man, we should do an album together, you know, like, and it's good, but it doesn't always pan out.
You know, maybe that's where the breakdown happened, because, you know, Billy was with the Bulls, you know, and, you know,
right.
Yeah, that's where the beef came in, you know, like, I mean... Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, if you got Jordan there and he's like, you know, giving Shaq some shit, then, you know, he's like, Billy, I don't think I can work with you. And he said it just like that. He goes, Billy, I'm so sorry, but I just can't, you know, your friend, Michael Jordan, he's hurting my feelings. Please, Billy, we
can't
work.
That's the thing about professional sports. It's like the players' feelings get hurt. When someone's trying to beat their team, that hurts.
That hurts.
That's that's a betrayal. You know?
How could you? I was playing my best and you beat me at the basketball game.
It's fucked up. It's not cool.
No, it's not cool. I think everybody should win.
Yeah, everybody gets a trophy.
We're saying that. Everybody gets a trophy. We're liberal snowflakes. Deal with it.
Yep. Participation medals are what we believe in. And
hand them out.
Yep. Hand them out. Everyone listening will get a trophy.
But we're going to send it through the Warner Brothers store that the Pumpkins use for their website. So you'll get it in 4 months.
Yeah. So check it out. All right, so should we dive into this thing? There's so much music. We're not gonna do a deep dive on every single track, but
no. So what we'll do is first we'll talk about the track "I," and then we'll talk about its variations, and then we'll go into the soundtrack itself. How does that sound, Pat?
That sounds good. Let's do
it. All right, let's do it. So the first track we'll be talking about is "I." Patrick Shaquille O'Neal O'Brien, what do you think about this?
That is my full name. This is one of my favorite Pumpkin songs. I think it holds a special place for a lot of people. Like, if I'm placing it in context of my fandom as it was happening in time, like I was saying, like, I was so excited about this band's music to begin with. But this just really lit. I was like so passionately excited about this because of, like I said, how different it was, what a new direction it was, and how it still fucking ruled. It's honestly, I'm finding it hard to even describe like the specific elements that I love most about it, because it is, if you take it, you know, like in context of what came before, everything about it is different, you know? It was just the kind of punch of the track itself, but I will say it also really works well in the context of this soundtrack. Like the music, the way that the everything weaves together, and it's kind of sandwiched in between two Angelo Badalamenti pieces, Haunting and Heartbreaking, and then Dub Driving, and they kind of weave into this song. Like by the time you get to this, on the soundtrack, it's been a couple sort of instrumental, more score type, or, you know, instrumental tracks.
Yeah.
So this is like such a punch in the eardrum. And it just, I don't know, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, to your point, I think the track Ugly lit the fuse, and this is the explosion that came out of it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think that the seeds of this track were in those like melancholy B-sides, like Ugly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it for me, I immediately was hooked from the first note, from like mm-hmm. the first notes of that keyboard. I was just like, whoa, this sounds so cool. It sounds so, it like was singing to the little goth part of my heart, you know, that yeah. I was like, my favorite band can do this type of music too. Like, yeah. fuck, right. yes. I was like exactly. so into it. And then like, you know, the little xylophone part and the layers work so well. And then mm-hmm. when he does that turn to the gates of heaven, like that part has Lynch-like keyboards, you know, that mm-hmm. were on Twin Peaks. And I was right. like, man, this is right on the money and right in the tone of like that Lynch world.
Yeah.
And I was like, this song, there are elements of the song with like the drum beat, and because you could even make the argument that the drum sample is a little bit like simplistic mm-hmm. For drum samples, but with the tones and the lyrics and everything working together, again, it's another example of this shouldn't work yet.
Mm-hmm.
It works so well.
Yeah. And I think the spot, I totally agree. It is a maybe like the beat is a little sparse or something. I was going to say rudimentary, but yeah. like I think if it's deliberately that, and maybe it is rudimentary, you know, but this was Billy's like, you know, sort of foray into like playing with this kind of stuff. But I'm always a big proponent of like music to rule does not have to be, and this gets very, this is a pretty complex song. There's like a lot of layers of paint on it, and it again like builds in the layer, you know, layers and layers on. But like, you know, music to be effective and to move you does not have to be intricate. Like the simplicity of this drum beat, it like works for it, you know, and it's like a pulsing, it's like it's the whole thing is like a new ground in Pumpkin World, but also like you said, very Lynchian, very you know, Billy's version of at this time sort of Reznorian, I guess you could say. Like it just it's like at the intersection highway, Lost Highway, of all these like other musicians and the film itself. Like it just works, and it is the centerpiece, I think, of, you know, of a great album.
Yeah, I think, to me, I don't think it's so much him doing Trent as much it is of him trying to copy the production of a Missy Elliott or a Busta Rhymes.
Sure, yeah, but that's then, actually what he said, yeah.
Yeah, and then using the filter of his Lynch, because I'm sure after the fact that David Lynch said no thanks to Tear, mm-hmm. he was like, well, how is something I can do that's a little bit more in that with this other element that I'm toying with? Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, it's a little undeniable. I think it's hard to, I mean, I think there is a Trent influence on there as well. I mean, it's hard to deny it because it's right there in the soundtrack and it fits so well that mm-hmm. it's hard not to think that like, oh, there is a little bit of influence sure. in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, for sure, with the production, the at least the programming, it did feel like more like Busta Rhymes, Missy Elliott type of, you know, sound to it.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think is? Do you think it's all Billy singing on it?
As far as I can hear, and I was actually curious because Billy produced this himself. Billy, like, I was curious in what. I actually took a photo of the credits when I was watching the movie when it got to the music part, when it got to this part, and I'm looking at it now.
Can you show that to our listeners right now?
Yeah, here it is.
Cool. So I'll give you time to look at that, listeners, just so that you can fully take that in. And all right, let's talk about it, Pat.
I will read it, and maybe throw it up on the Instagram. Who cares? written by Billy Corgan, produced and mixed by Billy Corgan, performed by Smashing Pumpkins, recorded at Soundwork Chicago, mixed at Chung King New York, recording engineer Jeff Molesky, mixing engineer Neil Perry, technical engineer Tommy Lipnick. Assisted by J. Nicholas and G. Langus, 1996, Chrysalis Songs, Cinderful Music, Smashing Pumpkins appear courtesy of. And then the photo cuts off, but we'll say Virgin Records. But I'm curious because it's written, produced and mixed by Billy Corgan and performed by Billy Corgan. I'm curious in what capacity the other band members performed on this. I assume they did, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, because I have a feeling they were more involved in the end as the beginning as the end, and this mm-hmm. might have been more of a solo thing.
It seems like it. If he was sort of working with elements he'd been tinkering around with for Shaq.
Yeah, based off our research, I couldn't really find anything on the contrary, but listeners, if you happen to know, let us know.
Yeah, it's just tough to know, but it seems like this was something that was not necessarily done the full band. Like Billy, if nothing else, was working, toiling away at this on his own, like largely doing it on his own. But I don't know. We don't know.
Yeah. Other elements. I mean, that ending is probably my favorite. Definitely in my top 10. Like pumpkin songs of like mm-hmm. how it like kind of pays off.
So good.
Because it's so good. Like just how it builds with that gothic choir part. Sounds oh, yeah. awesome, which would come in again. On this version, the original soundtrack version, it's a little bit more prominent. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into the remastered on a door version. But on this version, it's more prominent and it has a more of that creepy build and like kind of muddiness to it. And mm-hmm. it's I love that build and payoff. And you hear a bit of that element on Seer as mm-hmm. well, where we talked about that gothic choir, you know, type of sound. Mm-hmm. And it just, the way it's mixed and mastered, it just swirls, you know, within your headphones. And
I was just going to say, that's a great headphone listen. I was listening to it. I took a little short walk at night, with headphones on. And
what were you up to, Pat? Causing trouble?
Yeah, I was out, you know, no mask, just
breaking windows and shit.
Yeah, but it's a great, man. That's a walking around LA at night with your headphones on. This is a great way to experience the Lost Highway soundtrack. That's for sure.
I bet
it's a creepy LA movie too. I when I watched it again, when I watched it for the first time, I was years away from ever having set foot in Los Angeles. And if you've never been here, there's a creepiness that like Lynch and you watch and you're a fan of David Lynch. A lot of his stuff is set in LA, and there is some weird freakiness yeah. like that boils under the surface here that he captures really well. So just, you know, picture that.
That's funny that you mentioned that, Pat, because I mean, I'm sure we're not the only ones to say this, but like there definitely is a weirdness that lies beneath the sheen of Los Angeles. I don't know. For right sure. now, the Los Angeles feels pretty dire and apocalyptic, not apocalyptic, but it's you know, it's lost a little bit of its sheen over the year, over this pandemic, because of, you know, hard times and just everybody kind of losing their mind, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's always been like that element of being like, hey, Hollywood. And then also mm-hmm. this very dark undercurrent that you're like, this place gives me the creeps.
Yeah. And I think it's the like the gloss and the sheen and the glitz and the glamour, and then juxtaposed with the kind of decay, both of like, you know, the play, like buildings and just old stuff kind of being next to new stuff, and like, I don't know, exploitation of people and of, and just, and then just this weird X factor that you can't even quite put to words, but his movies
capture
something about it for
I agree. That end, like kind of part where it does that repeat and scratchy, you know, repeats noise, mm-hmm. like the beat, the drum beat is pretty cool. It goes on just as long as it needs to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I love an abrupt ending too.
Like,
as opposed to like a fade out, you know, it's just like a boom. And then
that's again, the whole soundtrack
eases into like a much jazzier
dub driving.
Dub driving. Yeah. Which is a great track.
Which every time I heard I would always hear that right after.
Oh, the sequencing of this album is forever seared into my brain. Yeah. Like one, I can't hear one without picturing, like hearing what
comes after,
comes next.
Yeah.
Like forever.
Oh.
And I love it.
I feel like the production on this was very interesting in a very kind of Nine Inch Nails-y thing where certain tracks, like one little note will bleed into the other.
Mm-hmm.
Like either at the tail end or the very beginning, which can kind of be annoying for mixes, but
sure,
you know, like especially like the beginning of Perfect Drug, which we'll get into, part of it's like a little cut off, and you know, even the end of I, you know, how it kind of cuts off. But yeah, I mean, this original version of I is, I personally prefer it. Maybe
Me
it's just
too.
Because I'm used to it, but like the production and the kind of like there's this heaviness to it that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. It's like all these songs on here, and the same goes for watching a Lynch movie, you know, on a TV with speakers plugged into it. Like the low end of all this, like just rattle, like it rattles, it like, you know, you can kind of feel like if you're listening to it loudly, you can kind of feel all this music like in your belly a little bit, like
it's
which is a very, you know, I think a very satisfying experience for listening to music.
It's just one of my favorite Pumpkin songs of all time, and I love that they play it live, and mm-hmm. the Linda Strawberry visuals to it were really cool and creepy.
I also remember seeing this live for the first time. I saw it in the Shiny tour, but then before that, he played it, or they played it on the In Plain Song tour.
Right.
Which was and it was like, I think they played Lily, My One and Only, I, and Saturnine, among many other great songs, but those three are like such personal favorites of mine that I was like, holy shit, this concert feels like tailor-made from, you know, like my, you know, I know a lot of people love those songs, but it was amazing. It was like a total mind blow. Fun fact, having just watched the movie, the part in the movie where this song actually plays
in the club scene,
in the club scene, or they're in like a bowling alley, like, you know, club, so the lyrics go, in the movie version, he just says, is it any wonder I can't sleep? Repeat, is it any wonder I can't sleep?
And what?
Yeah, yeah. I rewound it. I listened to it. But to my point earlier about the character, Bill Pullman's character, after apparently killing his wife and not really remembering it or knowing it or disassociating from it and freaking out and having headaches, he can't sleep. That's what he keeps telling the prison guards. So again, it's like the lyric
choice.
These were just lyrics that I had gotten used to as being cool, interesting lyrics, but it is directly dealing with part of the movie. So there you go. But that, hearing that, I was like, wait a minute, I know this too. Like, you know, I dove for my remote to rewind it. I dropped my, as I said to Frank earlier, I don't think we were recording yet, but I've my wife is like, you know, she has good taste in movies and stuff, and she, you know, we've watched, I think she's just a little too freaked out by David Lynch stuff, and we've watched, like, we watched the new Twin Peaks together, and all this week I was like, hey, would you maybe want to watch Lost Highway with me? Like, Frank and I are talking about the soundtrack, and she's like, yeah. And then conveniently she wound up having a Zoom call with an old friend, so I was like, well, I'm watching it by myself, and I ate half a pizza, and I watched Lost Highway in its entirety with the lights turned down low. So,
hey, Pat, what do you like on your pizza, huh?
Dude, I actually got, I got pepperoni, and I a couple of years ago I started becoming a freak who occasionally likes to get anchovies on my pizza.
Oh,
so I got,
yeah, yeah,
anchovies. They're really good.
We're of that age now,
dude. Oh man, do you remember? I once wrote, this is a big tangent, but Frank and I are both we met sort of in the sketch comedy world, and we both wrote and write comedy sketches, but one of my favorites that I ever wrote, and it was based on just a general vibe of the pop culture we grew up on, it was called No Anchovies, and it was about a guy, like, just friends ordering pizza at a pizza place, and the guy, everyone was saying what they wanted on their pizza, and the guy was like, I'll take pepperoni, mushrooms, sausage, oh, and no anchovies. You put anchovies on this thing, I'm going to pop you. You know, you and I are going to have problems. But, like, the thing of people in movies having to really be stern with the pizza place about not,
yeah,
like, sneaking anchovies on there for some reason when you didn't order them. Like, A, they're not a cheap topping. B, like, who is trying to make you eat anchovies all the time? Like, it's just a funny,
Pat,
you know.
You don't remember the problems we had in the 80s and the 90s of pizza places forcing you to eat anchovies.
Well, then the sketch culminates with a sort of jazz, like, annoyed like character called the pizza sneak who speaks in rhyme, like sing-song rhyme, and he sneaks he goes around trying to ruin pizzas with anchovies, and they end up killing him with a song. So anyway, all that to say, I don't know if anybody relates to that out there, but we grew up with a lot of shit. Movies, I think there was a scene in E.T., certainly Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, yeah, obviously.
Oh, but no anchovies. And I mean no anchovies. You put anchovies on this thing and you're in big trouble, okay?
I can't let you know.
That'll do. And the clock's ticking, dude.
But other stuff, too. Anytime a dude is ordering pizza for delivery in the 80s or 90s, he's like, oh, and bro, no anchovies. You sneak so much as one anchovy on this thing, you and I are going to have problems.
I thought I said no anchovies.
So, any final thoughts on the original soundtrack version of I?
Love it.
Yeah, I love it too. One of my absolute favorites. Probably top 10.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say it.
Same.
I'm
definitely
on record. Top 10. So now we're going to talk about the remastered version on A Door. And that track, you guessed it, I.
Is it any wonder I can't sleep? All I have is all you get to me.
Pat, what are your thoughts on the remastered version?
The differences are subtle. But I also prefer the original, which I think is just that thing of it being burned into my memory. That I feel that way about most remastered Pumpkin songs that are altered, not just in, like, mixing, but in terms of, like, some element being, well, I guess that's what mixing can do, but, like, Glynnis, for example,
right?
There's, like, a slightly different vocal track, I think, or at the end it's different. So I think to me, these, honestly, everything with this band is up to a point is like so burned into my childhood memories that it would be hard. And we're like we were saying with the hearing the songs that feed into and out of it, that's such a part of it. Like, so I'm sensitive to changes about it, I guess. So I think I do prefer the original for that reason.
Yeah, I like this remastered version or remixed version, however, whatever the technical term for it is. But kind of going back to what we're talking about, how Billy was posting on his stories about the Machina reissue that's about to come out. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's what happened with this track, because there's a lot of different... The first time I heard it, I was like, oh, it's very subtle. But then I re-listened to it with headphones and I caught a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's cleaner and more prominent, you know, of course, with the sound, it's more bright. And the sounds, it sounds like a slightly different vocal track. Mm-hmm. And like I said before, I personally like the dust on the original one a bit more, but I feel like this is what we're going to get with Machina, where you're getting like brighter takes or maybe a different take that feels like maybe a little bit more, I don't know, cleaned up, vocally. But then like, when he says turn, there's a repeat on it on this version. Mm-hmm. And it's on the original, but it's kind of buried in the mix. And with this one, it's brought up more, right, where you hear that repeat after he has turned. And then there's a low pass filter kind of effect when he says I. And that's a new thing where it's like, oh, again, it feels like they're just amping up the little production choices. And there's more chorus and layering on It's Not Enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I guess there's room for more chorus and layering on that. And then there's also the vocal take somewhere where he says, where he just says, is it any wonder I can't sleep again? Instead
yeah,
of the
he
other
says it twice. It's his pizza pizza.
Right.
Back to pizza. But yeah, there's also a weird sustain that goes into the second verse that I'd never noticed. And then you can hear the guitar part a little bit clearer too.
Yeah, I guess that's not surprising. But yeah, like you said, the dust, sometimes a little like the dust becomes part of it. You know, it becomes an instrument unto itself.
Yeah. Other things I noticed, there's a repeat and chorus that's doing this like double sweep staccato thing, delayed vocal that swirls around during that just a touch part. That gothic choir is not as prominent, so there he's doing more with like the vocal stuff when he's singing, and the gothic choir stuff is like just a little bit more subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the keyboards at the end sound like a little bit more thicker with the drum beat.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That was probably boring, all the technical stuff I just mentioned, but basically that's all to say. It just feels like he just brought out more of the stuff that he wanted, that he felt maybe was buried in the original mix. But for me personally, I like the original mix.
Yeah, I think I do too. And I think that's also the original mix. It's unchanged on the Rotten Apples collection, because it wasn't remastered until 2014, right? So that
correct.
Was like, yeah, yeah.
And then there's also a the piano version, which appears on the Melancholy reissue, and this one is just kind of just him with a piano. It's just kind of interesting to hear it really that stripped down. It feels like more like a Tonight Tonight single. when you hear it, you know, like one of the B-sides from Tonight Tonight, when you hear it that way.
Is it any wonder I can't sleep? All I have is all you gave to me. Is it any wonder I found peace through?
Yeah, this is a great example. Like when you were talking about how Tonight Tonight has sort of a, you can feel or detect sort of like a new wave quality to it, or you can almost like imagine, like the, as we've kind of wound up talking about a lot, like everything with Billy starts with, it's got to kind of work on piano or acoustic or something. So like, but the way, the different directions you can go. Yeah, it's just interesting, like to because I guess that like the essence of the song, I don't know. To me, the essence of I though is the instrumentation and is the, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's like yeah, I don't know. Like it like Tonight Tonight, I feel like the song, even as much as we love the single version, the big orchestral version, there's something about the stripped down acoustic one that still fully kind of captures the essence of the song. But like I, to me, is just so much about that production.
Yeah, I feel like it's interesting. It's just so cool to hear like how Billy kind of starts with one place and where it ends up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I like about having those demos, even though it's overwhelming to listen to a lot of that stuff that came out with the reissues.
Yeah.
It's really cool to have that just to kind of see where it started.
Yeah. We have other tracks to talk about, but the movie features more than cameos, but small parts by Richard Pryor, Henry Rollins, who I'm a huge fan of.
Your short film.
Yeah, I've gotten to meet him and work with him on a couple of different occasions. He's the coolest guy. He's like, he's exactly, if you're a Rollins fan, he's all the things you'd want him to be, except he's also like a very sweet gentleman of a man too. Like he's just like he's the coolest. But he, and I've gotten to know his kind of like producing partner, Heidi May, who's like his manager, and also kind of like, they're also kind of like best friend. Like they're very like sweet together, and she's awesome. I've stayed in touch with her, which is like kind of how I've gotten to continue to work with him a couple times. But they do an occasional podcast together where she kind of just like interviews him about like some experience he's had along the way. And he did one about Lost Highway, about the experience of like kind of being like, the movie was almost done, but there was still more stuff to shoot. And, or maybe not, I guess it couldn't have been almost done, but there was like, the movie was like, you know, underway, but that he wanted to like round it out with just like people he was a fan of. So he called up Henry and asked like, can you do a small part in this? And so it was just interesting to hear Henry describe the experience, which included like going to set and in between takes or in between setups and stuff, David Lynch at that time, maybe he always does this, but like between takes, he'll just have these huge speakers and just be blaring music. And at the time he was like, he was blaring Rammstein, and he was like, I want you to hear this. They're my new favorite band. They're called Rammstein. And so clearly he was into Rammstein, because Rammstein, I guess we could kind of like dip in and out of just the Rammstein tracks. I really dig them, and I was reading more about them today because and they've never gone away as a band, and they've actually been like much more, like they've had like more number one hits than I would have guessed. But the Rammstein tracks I would maybe not listen to as much, just because I feel like you got to be in the right mood to listen to
for
Rammstein.
Sure.
Yeah, but apparently he would blare Rammstein on set during the making of this film.
Interesting. Yeah, because one of the songs, the title track, you know, their namesake song, is about the air show disaster.
Rammstein.
And the lyrics are pretty disturbing if you translate them. Not my bag. Rammstein was a fun kind of, like, you know, with Du Hast. You know, if you remember that, that was big when we were in high school or whatever. Who
could forget?
Who could forget it? How can you not with how aggressively German it is? But yeah, that band just wasn't for me, you know. That I think there were some cool riffs and stuff, but yeah, it just wasn't my thing.
Mm-hmm. So there's a few singles off this. One of them is I, and then of course, The Perfect Drug by Nine Inch Nails.
I come along, but I don't know where you're taking me. I shouldn't go, but you're reaching, dragging, shaking me. Turn off the sun, pull the stars from the sky. The more I give to you, the more I die.
Yeah, Pat, what are your thoughts on Perfect Drug?
I mean, not to sound basic, but, like, it's an amazing song. I love this song. I love this song. This was, like, I was second most excited at the time of getting this album about this song. Even it was a big single. I remember the video really well. He's, like, drinking absinthe and stuff. But this kind of is a Nine Inch Nails song that, like, it has little movements that show all the best things about Nine Inch Nails. You know, you've got your slow atmospheric quiet parts. You've got, like, the kind of pained, like belting it out, singing kind of parts. And then you've got just the pure cacophony, insanity parts. And that's the part that actually played in the movie. Lost Highway.
Yeah. Well, around this time, you know, my fandom for Nine Inch Nails was, I was certainly more of a Pumpkins fan, but I, if not equal to, you know, Nine Inch Nails as well, I was really into Nine Inch Nails at this time with Downward Spiral, and I was too afraid to see them live because of, like, how it looked like the shows went, like they were maybe a little too rowdy for me. But then when The Fragile came out, I finally saw them live, and I've probably seen them every time they've toured on an album. I've probably missed a few, but they're one of the best live bands you can see live.
Yeah, I think I've actually only seen them once, but it was on the Fragile tour, and it was awesome. And Perfect Circle opened for them.
Yeah, that's the one. I saw that one. Yeah, The Perfect Drug is just one of the best Nine Inch Nails songs, even though he doesn't like it.
Oh, he doesn't?
Trent says, the only thing I think I really don't like that much is The Perfect Drug. It was one of those things where you have a week to do a track for a movie. The mindset that you kind of adapt in that situation, or I did, was, let's go in and experiment and see what happens. And it's not, you know, whatever comes out of it, it's not the end of the world. And I think what came out of it, married with a bloated over-budget video, feels like the last thing that I would play to somebody if they say, play me, you know, the top 100 songs you've written. That probably wouldn't be in the top 100 at all. I'm not cringing about it, but it's not my favorite piece. So
sounds like he doesn't like the video.
Mark Romanek, you know, who does a lot of amazing videos, very stylistic video where it's inspired by the art of Edward Gorey and allegedly depicts the story of a man addicted to absinthe whilst mourning the death of his son.
You know, I could see Trent Reznor, especially the way he's grown and the sort of role he has now, like, I could see him. It's funny that he mentions the video, maybe he feels it's a little too on the nose, like creepy or a little too like spooky, you know, like it sounds like he's a little embarrassed of maybe among other things, but the video, I could see him like cringing or recoiling a little bit at being like, I don't know, you know, like too much of like a Adam's Family aesthetic or something. You know what I mean? Like too,
like, yeah, very like Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, right.
You know, yes. Like he doesn't want to really kind of be drawn into that type of, you know, world.
Yeah, but like I could see him wanting to be remembered more like, well, probably just as Trent Reznor, but like more Brian Eno, less, you know, Alice Cooper or something, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Brian Eno does appear on this soundtrack as well.
He does.
But I think this song is like one of my absolute favorites, even though he doesn't like it. I think the drums are great. It's a bit of the Fragile guitar. You know, we get a little preview of what you'd hear more of the guitar work on the Fragile. Again, kind of this uses a little bit of basic techno beats, but just kind of through the Nine Inch Nails filter. And it's such a unique arrangement. Right. The lyric "Yellow" goes straight through my heart. I don't know what that means, but it's fun. And then the ooze part is very Bowie to me.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I just love the distorted guitars going into the second chorus. I love how it builds, and then the drum breakdown section, which was edited for the single. It's a little bit longer in the soundtrack version and more electronic, and the sound design is amazing. You know, it's got these like bubbling sounds, and he talks about this on that Song Exploder episode I talked about in the End is the Beginning is the End episode, where they basically approach doing the mixing and stuff for their music the same way they do sound design for a movie. So it was already in him to be doing like scores and stuff, because he was thinking more, because there are tones that they bury within the track that movies do for their sound design to make you feel a certain way.
Yeah, it's such a good pairing, David Lynch and Trent Reznor, because they're both that way. Like David Lynch he's more of an amateur. He's a musician. He is a musician too.
Yeah,
but he's very musical about his films, and he like personally does a lot of the sound design, and a lot of it is just these sort of beds of like tones, like deep, that you barely even like hear, but you feel like they create like usually a very unsettling feeling. It is a perfect creative combination.
Yeah, I also love the end of the song is one of my favorite probably parts of any Nine Inch Nails song, that Without You Everything Falls Apart. Because just the string scrape sound and those distorted guitars and the tasteful like drums, it just sounds, it's such a mood, kind of going back to where we were talking about the sound design. And then that piano, it just all works together that you feel it, you know, and like the little Mellotron strings too, it sounds like, and how sparse it is. It's just so quiet and somber, and it just really creates this mood that I absolutely love.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of, we mentioned Brian Eno and David Bowie, and we're jumping around a little bit, but
why not?
Hey, too bad, guys. hey, time is nonlinear in Lynch movies, so why should track lists be? The first track is by David Bowie from his album Outside, or maybe you say One Outside, which is an album that I've gotten into sort of in recent years, and it's amazing. I really want to continue to dig into like his 90s stuff.
Yeah,
maybe it'll be a side podcast, who knows.
Well, speaking of that, we'll get to that later, but we have a sort of special guest that'll be joining us for this show later, and this special guest or guests have covered the 90s era Bowie, but we'll get to that later.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is 90s era Bowie, and it's called I'm Deranged.
Funny how secrets travel. I start to believe if I was in need, Pink Sky, the man shakes his hands held high. A cruise beyond.
Written by Brian Eno and David Bowie, this almost reminds me of the J.G. Thirlwell Venture Brothers theme.
Oh, you know, I haven't seen that in so long, but they probably copied it.
Yeah, they're huge Bowie fans, so they even have a character that's Bowie in the show, so yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They even make a Eno reference, too.
Oh, nice, yeah. So this, unlike some of these other songs that were written for the soundtrack, this is from, I believe, the Bowie album that came out in 1995. So this was a pre-existing Bowie song that's... was definitely sort of sonically finding him playing in the same, you know, he obviously collaborated with Trent Reznor himself.
Yeah.
Bowie's always on the cutting edge, man. He fucking rules. But like, and it feels like this was a time when Bowie was really surrounding himself with younger, interesting artists. A lot of the people who played at his 50th birthday party, including Billy, are represented on here.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a cool song. That it's interesting on Spotify for some reason, on the Spotify Lost Highway soundtrack, I guess because it's I'm Deranged edit, it's edited for the soundtrack. Uh-huh. It's not available. Huh. You can't listen to it, but then you could just listen to the one on the album, which is, besides being, you know, an edit of it, it's I believe the same track. And then this track also appears at the very end of the soundtrack, and also the movie itself opens and closes with this song, along with footage of just the highway lines zipping by with like a black background. So this bookends the soundtrack and the movie as well.
Hmm. Yeah, I love the guitar sounds on it, and I always love when Bowie does crooner. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could appreciate it at the time. I loved mm-hmm. Bowie, but like I just also like was like, okay, I kind of would like just go to the perfect drug.
I think I would too at the time.
Yeah,
I think I didn't appreciate.
I couldn't appreciate '90s Bowie as much. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and I think a lot of people
took it for granted.
But I don't think I even at this point had fully. You know, I knew the hits and stuff, but I don't think I had, because I was so focused on 90s music
yeah.
still, you know, like, I don't think I had really delved deep into Bowie albums and realized, like, how amazing he wasn't just, like, a rock star of yesteryear. He was, like, a true sort of constant musical pioneer who had a lot more to do with the shit that I was into than I thought, you know?
Yeah, and this was... a few years after Outside, and Earthling just came out the week before this soundtrack. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I, you know, it's funny just because they just did the Bowie at the time of this recording. They just did the Bowie birthday concert with Billy and Trent as well. Billy did Space Oddity, and yeah, it to me, it's funny because I'm thinking like, oh, Bowie at this time when he's working with Billy or kind of associating with Billy and Trent, they started their journey kind of on like what he was already on. Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like where it's like he was in the period where it's like true fans really love those albums, but the general masses were kind of like, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then like it was at that period that this soundtrack came out that the tide started to turn for both of those bands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what
it's
I mean?
True. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what I'm trying to say with that, but basically just saying that I see that Trent and Billy are kind of like on that same trajectory as Bowie mm-hmm. with being like they don't compromise their vision they do what they want to do, and people either love it or they hate it, you know. I think Trent has a little bit more critical acclaim, but it's still that same thing where fans still complain about the fact that it's not like Downward Spiral and stuff, and they complain it's not Siamese Dream or whatever.
Totally. Yeah. They're willing to endure, because I feel like I guess there was a period where Nine Inch Nails technically like broke up or went away.
Yeah, they retired, quote unquote. Yeah. And then they came back. Yeah.
But there was a period probably kind of coinciding with the Pumpkins, which, you know, who were broken up for part of this, but where like, I guess just to agree with you and say that all these people you mentioned are willing to endure periods of sort of like, for the sake of artistic integrity and artistic growth, they'll like stick it out through periods of not being as popular anymore, or like people not appreciating them in real time for something that they believe in the long run will, you know, be part of like the artistic kind of tapestry they want to leave behind. So
same for The Cure, you know, like I believe that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, then you've got, you know, we won't have time to go through every track on here, but you've got more kind of score type stuff from both Trent and, of course, Angelo Badalamenti, who a lot of the music in this film is not score. It's like the Bill Pullman's character is a jazz musician.
Yeah.
So the song Red Bats with Wings, or with Teeth rather, is like that ripping jazz song that you see him play, you know, piece that you see him play in the movie, which I think rules. Like, this soundtrack got me my young self kind of opening up a little bit to like, oh, maybe jazz would be sick, you know, like maybe jazz rules. So like the end of Red Bats with Teeth, where it's like a total saxophone freak out.
Yeah.
I believe I read something with David Lynch kind of like coaching Angelo or whoever was playing this, maybe he wasn't playing it, but to just like go harder, go more nuts, like, you know, and it really shows.
Yeah, but like Trent's scores too are really cool. Like Driver Down was probably my favorite because it reminded me of Broken Era, Nine Inch Nails, and had the Downward Spiral type piano. But he is playing sax on that because he was a saxophone player in marching band. He played a lot of stuff, but he also started playing sax again on Nine Inch Nails records when they released the EPs. It would come back later with the Ad Violence EP and the Bad Witch EP.
Which is great. I love that one.
Yeah, it's so good. But
both of those.
But yeah, the tracks Play the Goddamn Part, God Break Down the Door, and on This Isn't the Place on Ad Violence, those had those sax tracks on it. And I got to see them the last time they toured Nine Inch Nails. I saw them and he played sax live, and it was like really like interesting. Some people were into it and some were like, what is this? Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, but I loved
he's channeling his Lizzo, you know. It's right? Like, play your childhood instrument, the people will like it, or you know, maybe they won't, but so there's Trent, Angelo Badalamenti, and then Barry Adamson, who does these other pieces, but Mr. Eddie's Theme 1 and 2,
yeah,
which are cool. I like all his stuff on here too.
My favorite is Something Wicked This Way Comes.
That's a great one. And then again, we're jumping around, but Mr. Eddie's Theme, one of my favorite little transitions on here is from track 8 to track 9, Mr. Eddie's Theme 1 into This Magic Moment.
Yeah, Lou Reed.
This magic moment, so different and so new, was like any other until I met you.
Fucking amazing, amazing cover of this song.
I love it.
It's so great. This is one of those, like, it's one of my favorite Lou Reed songs. It just is, there's something like ominous and beautiful about it. It also works really. This is one of the few songs I was saying, like, the a lot of the just the movie is fresh on my mind, but a lot of the music that isn't more score or even like it is like the characters are hearing the music too. You know, they're at a party, yeah. They're in a jazz club, they're at a club. This is one of those moments where it's you see Patricia Arquette's character, or like version two of her character, kind of revealed for the first time in kind of slow-mo, and this song plays. It works so well. Again, for a cover of an old, like, surprisingly lyrically works for the movie, because it's like the guy seeing this woman for the first time who is actually his wife, who he's known, who he killed, you know. But man, I loved this song. This has always been one of those, like, by the time this song rolls around on the soundtrack, I'm like, holy shit, that, like, it, just floored by how good it is.
Yeah, I actually have a Lou Reed story that I met him.
Wouldn't
say I met him, but here we go again with another Frank drug story. I swear to God, I'm not some kind of druggie, but...
It better be if it's Lou Reed.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. At the Comedy Theater we performed at, there was a gentleman who will remain nameless, but would sell weed cookies at parties.
Mm-hmm.
And I... My roommate and I at that time were like, hey, let's get some of these weed cookies and we'll have them for later. And about a week after that, we were like, maybe not a week, maybe it was a few days after that. We were like, hey, let's go to the Angelica Film Center, or was it the IFC Center? I can't remember which one it was, but it was one of those movie houses, you know, the independent movie places in New York. And we're like, let's go see Let the Right One In, the original one, the Swedish one, right? We were like, let's take a cookie and let's go see that movie.
Nice. So far so good.
We're already kind of planning terribly, but so we take the cookie, we hop on the subway, we get our seats, and we're like waiting for it to kick in, and then my roommate like nudges me and he's like, hey, look at that little old lady over there, doesn't that look like Lou Reed? And I was like, oh, yeah, and she looks like, you know, she's with Laurie Anderson. They kind of look like Lou Reed and Laurie Anderson, you know, his wife or his partner. We were like, ha, 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 and we were, like, sitting down, and then they started coming towards us, and we're like, oh, no, holy fuck. And at that point, the cookie started hitting us, and he leans over to us, and he goes, are these seats taken? He's talking about the ones that were beside us. Wow. And it was him and Laurie Anderson and a friend of theirs. And we were like, no, go ahead and sit down. And they sat like a little further down the row from us. And the lights went down. And like, I remember the cookie hitting really hard and being like, all of a sudden in my head being like, holy fuck, that's Lou Reed. We're sitting by Lou Reed. We're about to watch a Swedish vampire movie, and that's fucking Lou Reed. And throughout the movie, I kept like trying not to look over, but I kept catching myself doing it a few times. And in my head, I kept going like, Lou Reed.
Yeah.
And then after the movie ends, they get up, they go in front of us, and we're behind them. And we're like, oh, do we say anything? Do we do anything? They're like, no, we can't. We will not ruin this moment.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's incredible. And Laurie Anderson rules, too.
She's awesome.
I've been recently, I have a just like a random mix that I keep adding to for years on Spotify.
Yeah.
And one of the recent ones is the one where they, off her album, In Our Sleep.
Yeah.
Where they both perform on it. Great song. They're both incredible. What a marriage, you know?
For real, like, just a New York, like...
Yeah, New York artists, that's the great thing about New York, too, or it was, or, you know, hope, like, you can end up at a movie with Lou Reed.
Yeah, I love New York. I miss New York so much, but, that's the kind of, like, moment you could have there. I would say, like, Laurie Anderson, for those of you who don't know, like, maybe a lot of people know her album Big Science probably the best, or probably, would you say that? Or, like, her live stuff probably more.
Yeah, I think the
talk
song,
normal.
Like, her live, like, I first learned about her in art school, actually, because, like, she did the Oh Superman thing.
Yeah.
Like, she's, like, a performance artist.
That's
she's
off of
a
Big
great,
Science, yeah.
Yeah, a great recording artist. but also was like an early electronic, like experimental, like performance, like she was both at the forefront of like performance art, performance based like music performance and like experimenting with like all sorts of stuff. But she's amazing.
Yeah, Oh Superman's probably her most popular song.
Yeah. And it's kind of got like vocoder or like
it's like
affected vocals and stuff.
Early Imogene Heap kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh Superman. Oh John.
Home of the Brave is another album that was big for her in Strange Angels, but yeah, I really love that cover.
Oh yeah, and so we talked about the Angelo Badalamenti. He's sort of David Lynch's right hand man. He's great. I listen to his stuff all the time. There's several tracks by him. We talked about Rammstein. Speaking of covers, though, there is another cover on here, and it is I Put a Spell on You.
I prefer the Hocus Pocus cover.
Sure.
But, you know, who doesn't, you know?
The Ladies of Hocus Pocus.
The Ladies of Hocus Pocus, one of the best movies of all time. And I'm not joking.
Yeah.
I love that movie.
I think that, yeah, it is a great movie.
I do love that
and
movie.
That's that's coming back too, right? Are they making a sequel to that?
I think so. I believe they are.
Yeah.
But anyway,
let's say yes.
Yeah,
let's spread that rumor.
We're not entertainment tonight. We don't know, but let's go ahead and just say that it's happening. But that's not the only Marilyn Manson track on here.
So we didn't dive into everything super detailed, but we kind of covered everything. But watching the movie, and I had this thought because I was listening to the soundtrack. And I was like, wait, this is like a very male, like as much as this rules, it's like very male heavy. Like there's no female artists on here, which I thought was a little unusual because like Julie Cruz, like David Lynch, like usually works with, you know, there's like a female singing usually in his stuff. But when you watch the movie, the climactic scene of it features the song Song to the Siren by This Mortal Coil.
Did I dream? You dreamed about me. Were you here when I was for sale? Now my foolish boy.
Which is just such an amazing song.
Which was used in Fire Walk With Me, though, right?
It was, okay, so this is what, it might have been, yes. And it's a song that David Lynch has carried with him for a long time. This Mortal Coil recorded a version of Song to the Siren that was released in 1983. And that's the one that's in the movie. It was featured in Lost Highway, but did not appear on the film soundtrack album. Lynch has stated that This Mortal Coil's version of the song inspired the first two albums by Julie Cruz, which were written, lyrics and music were written by David Lynch and Angelo Badalamenti, who are, you know, who did this soundtrack as well, and sung by Julie. They kind of like the three of them for her first couple of albums were sort of like Julie Cruz, and she's like in Twin Peaks, and she's does the main Twin Peaks theme song is on her first album and stuff. Also, he had previously intended to use the original version of the song to the Siren on Blue Velvet, but was prevented from doing so due to legal issues or budget limitations. So presumably that's the same reason why it couldn't be on the soundtrack to Lost Highway, but it is very much in the movie, and it is in many ways like the most prominently featured song in the movie. And it's also just a song that it's just like a really, really, really beautiful, amazing song that I only, I think I only discovered like a couple of years ago or something, or it's, yeah, but it that's one notable, very notable omission from the soundtrack. Probably the only one that, you know, you hear in the movie that isn't on the soundtrack for some reason.
Yeah, I love this Mortal Coil just because of like how the revolving door nature of, you know, of Elizabeth Frazier, who appears mm-hmm. on that track, you know, from Cocteau Twins.
Yes.
Which like just an incredible voice, just so beautiful, and you know how they just kind of work with different vocalists and stuff, and it's more of a revolving door project. But yeah, I love this mm-hmm. Mortal Coil so much.
Yeah, and the song was initially done by Tim Buckley, mm-hmm. father of Jeff Buckley. So yeah, there you go.
Man, Jeff Buckley, speaking of that, I'm sorry I don't remember this, listener, please forgive me. I want to say it was Matt Lockwood, maybe. I apologize if I'm wrong on this, but sent me a clip of Jeff Buckley from a documentary where he's looking through records and he's rocking out to Cherub Rock.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. Nice. There you go.
We're bringing it back to the Jeff. Pumpkins. If you've listened this far and you're like, why aren't they talking about the Pumpkins so much? But, you know, whatever.
I know. But you know what?
These are little side episodes.
I feel like people are going to go with us on this because what, you know, like I think a lot of big pumpkin heads out there probably like us, like spun this disc quite a bit. It contained this great Pumpkin song, but it also happens to just rule front to back. And the movie is worth checking out, you know, dim the lights. And the movie also, just a little fun fact, not fun fact, horrifying fact. David Lynch said he was very obsessed, or became obsessed with like watching, like everybody did, the O.J. Simpson trial, and with the idea of like how could someone who very much seems to have just committed double murder be able to like go out, smile, golf, continue to live life? Like, what does the human brain have to like do to itself in order to move forward like that, like after seemingly committing like an atrocious act? So that's kind of like what he said the movie is about.
Wow.
Or like what inspired the movie, like that, the idea of, and then he said later he learned that there's like a term for it called psychogenic fugue, when you go into like a fugue state, you know,
yeah.
fugue state afterwards. So anyway, that's, I did a little deep dive.
You're a huge OJ fan, so yeah, that's, of course, that's just something.
Well, it is. Well, honestly, I'm about to go watch the Buffalo Bills are doing really well this year. It's like, it's a weird thing. Like, his name is still up in the Bills Stadium, oh, I think, boy. As a football player. So yeah. It's Buffalo's the one.
Not for Naked Gun.
It's like, well, yeah, I do. You know, I do remember that, but Buffalo's the one town where you could be like, O.J. Simpson. Oh, yeah, the great football player.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're like,
yeah,
wait, but didn't he? Now? And they're like, no, the great football player.
The great football player. And that's all we'll say about it.
Oh.
And that's all we'll say about this.
Yeah. Folks. I will say one more thing. For those of you who are into like meditative stuff, I do, or creative meditative, or being creative and trying to, like, whenever you have writer's block, I do recommend David Lynch's audiobook, Catching the Big Fish.
It's awesome.
It's so good.
It's short, too.
Yeah.
It's short and sweet. Yeah, the audiobook version is the way to go.
Absolutely.
Because you get to hear him read it.
It's
and his
perfect.
Voice is great. Yeah, totally agree.
But you've heard us talk about this. We wanted to have this podcast on as a guest for the show because we're big fans of theirs. It was one of the podcasts that I had listened to when I was going through chemotherapy that helped inspire the idea to start the Smashing Pumpcast. And the podcast I'm talking about is Pod Like a Hole. Pod Like a Hole basically went through the entire Nine Inch Nails discography. Then for their second season, they went through the David Bowie discography. And now they're kind of hitting on important albums like Purple Rain, Pink Floyd's The Wall, et cetera, et cetera. But we wanted them to join us on this show, but we couldn't make the schedule work out. However, they decided to send us a little recording that we're going to put right here so you can hear their take on it. So take it away, Pod Like a Hole, guys.
While we went over Lost Highway quite a bit in our 5-year gap episode recorded in my old basement, but Eric, the Smashing Pumpkins, to you, did you have any time with them in the 90s? And I sounds like a song that's very much an Eric Anderson song of songs.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you, Steve and Mark, respectively. Of course, I'm Eric. We're Pod Like a Hole. But hey, listen, I do have a little bit of history. When I moved from great city of Sacramento to Tucson, Arizona, my friends came over. They threw a goodbye party for me. I just got in a boombox and they all bought me a CD each. They all brought a CD for me, so I had some music to listen to. And that's where I got the lion's share of Primus. I got some Nirvana, and I got Siamese Dream. And I really did like Siamese Dream when I was very sad and angry in Tucson, no friends. Disarm did it. It did it for me. It had the weight that I needed. And then I got Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, and I really liked it. I think a critical ear now. I don't revisit it too often, but at least those two albums I liked. I mean, I liked it enough. I saw them live for the Melancholy tour. But everything kind of came to a head with that song "I." Obviously, we've covered on our 5-year gap episode the Lost Highway soundtrack, where David Lynch, brought in Trent Reznor to do some score work and add a new song. Being a Nine Inch Nails super fan, I got that the day it came out. And, I liked Smashing Pumpkins, but I came out of left field, it was a little goth electro song. The beat sounds like it could have been made on like an 808 with a little guitar put over it, but Billy's vocals are great. It's a catchy little thing. It's got this like gothic choir in the background, probably all electronic choir, but nonetheless fit perfectly for the pastiche of that dark alt rock soundtrack. And I love that song and the soundtrack. And my friend that was 18 years old and I was only 16 snuck me into that movie so I could see it in one of the little art house theaters here in town. But anyways, Smashing Pumpkins, pretty good. I don't go back. I don't revisit them a lot, honestly. If a song comes on, one of my favorites comes on, I generally will enjoy it. Kind of makes me want to go revisit a full album here and there. But I will never skip I when it comes on. It's a top-notch track for this gentleman.
Mark, we were friends at the time, friends of the same age. We didn't have to stray outside our age group to make friends like Eric did. You and I were big fans of that soundtrack. And I know that a few times we sat and we said, oh, my God, this song "I" is great. We remember those days. We were sitting there. We were playing Quake, probably the time of Quake, and IRC. And you lean back in your dad's office there and say, Steve, the song "I" is perfect. As far as Smashing Pumpkins goes, I think they should make a whole album like this.
Great beats. You got Billy Corgan really leaning into like kind of a dark New Order type song. Great song. Very catchy.
Yeah, no, I've loved I. I've always loved I. I've always thought it was great. And as far as the Pumpkins go, it started, I remember very specifically, I bought the Siamese Dream album also because of Disarm on cassette at the Target in Rockland, California. And this is during my one foot in the CD, one foot in the cassette era, and I dug it. And Today is a song that touches me to this day. And between Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, I love that album so much. I for a final art project at the high school, I tried to do a pastel of the album cover. I don't know if you remember that, Mark, but I was really I really put some oomph into it. I don't know what happened to that masterpiece. It's probably hanging in somebody's living room somewhere. I hope it is. But, you know, the Melancholy, great album, deserving of all the accolades. And Adore, even, I think Adore, if they would have pivoted and headed in that direction full force, maybe that could have been a brave new world for them. And I was a moment in time for the Smashing Pumpkins where I think everything clicked. That's a great song, a testament to the power of the soundtracks in the 90s, of which we've talked about them many times. You had Spawn, you had Lost Highway, you had Judgment Night, you had The Crow.
Season four might just be 90s movie soundtracks. Just be careful.
I would not mind that. That's actually, you know, that's just ironic enough to where that will get us a lot of clicks from the, Vox.com type folks.
Sure.
But anyhow, so the official Pod Like a Whole stance is Smashing Pumpkins in the 90s. We were all fans because, of course, the age group. The song I, wonderful song.
What I appreciate about them is they took this shoegazy sound, which was very much in the underground rock, kind of hard because of kind of how noisy and layered that stuff was. It was kind of hard to make that commercial. And they took that and they dovetailed it with the 90s, like, post-punk alt-rock sound, and they made it very palatable, and I appreciate that. I think that gives them a spot in the pantheon for sure.
Well, that does it for us in our Smashing Pumpcast segment. Thanks for having us on, and back to you guys.
Thank you so much for doing that, for taking the time to appear on our show. This way, Pod Like a Hole. We really appreciate that. So make sure to check out their podcast, Pod Like a Hole, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Yes, and thank you to those guys, and thank you to all of you out there for taking this journey on this never-ending highway we call the Smashing Pumpcast. Yeah, man, this was a really fun one. I was looking forward to this,
yeah.
And it's, you know, this is always going to be one of my favorite albums. It's, you know, it which is saying something. You know, we've been talking a lot about soundtracks and how they're oftentimes bloated and like have some cool stuff, but it's kind of like a ploy to sell other records, like, that, you know, or at least in the 90s. But man, oh man, this is like one of the, like, this is top shelf 90s soundtrack right here. This is the good stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely a theme. It's definitely a feeling. It's definitely a tone, and it works mm-hmm. well as a whole. And this Pumpkins track, again, one of my favorites, and that some of those dark themes are just going to go with us into Adore.
Yep, that's right. And we are now going to go with ourselves into a door, the exit door of this episode, if you know what I'm saying. But we thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for more stuff. Follow us on the socials, if you'd like.
Correct. Instagram at Smashing Pumpcast, and cast is spelled K-A-S-T. Also on Twitter at Pumpkins Podcast, and podcast is spelled normal. You can also email us at thesmashingpumpcast@gmail.com, and cast is spelled K-A-S-T.
Yes, and until next time, we bid you all farewell
and good night.
Good night, Miss Rammstein. Goodbye.